Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to start in the vanity section. We're going to move into the royals, and it seems that the politics section is back, so we will have a full half hour of politics. Let's start with an in memoriam. Giorgio Armani, fashion paragon of sophistication and success, is dead at 91. The designer married Hollywood glamour with Italian tailoring to build a vast independent luxury empire. This is by Jessica Iredale on September 4th. Fashion is a serious job, and a wonderful one for that matter, Giorgio Armani said when I interviewed him in late 2021. At the time, Armani was 87 years old, his job not yet done. He remained deeply entrenched in the daily operations of Giorgio Armani Spa, the multi-billion dollar luxury business spanning fashion, home, hospitality, sports, and philanthropy that he built from the ground up and operated independently. He held the titles of chairman, chief executive officer, and creative director of his company until his death Thursday at age 91. The Armani Group announced the news in a statement signed by his employees and family, which read, "Mr. Armani, as he was always called with respect and admiration by employees and collaborators, passed away peacefully surrounded by his loved ones. Tireless, he worked until his final days, dedicating himself to the company, its collections, and the diverse and ever-new projects both existing and in progress." Over the years, Giorgio Armani created a vision that extended from fashion to every aspect of living, anticipating the times with extraordinary clarity and concreteness. He was guided by an inexhaustible curiosity and a focus on the present and people. Along his path, he created an open dialogue with the public, becoming a beloved and respected figure for his ability to communicate with everyone. Always attentive to the needs of the community, he was committed on many fronts, especially toward his beloved Milan. Giorgio Armani is a company with 50 years of history, grown with emotion and patience. Giorgio Armani has always made independence, both in thought and action, his hallmark. The company is the reflection, today and always, of this feeling. The family and employees will carry the group forward with respect and continuity of these values. In this company, we have always felt part of the family. Today, with deep emotion, we feel the void left by those founded in this family and nurtured it with vision, passion, and dedication. But it is precisely in his spirit that together, we employees and the family members who have always worked alongside Mr. Armani are committed to protecting what he built and to carrying on his company in his memory with respect, responsibility, and love. Over the course of his monumental 50-plus year career, King Giorgio, as he became known within the fashion industry, was synonymous with many things. His perennial tan, crystal blue eyes, and white hair, offset by his studied uniform of navy crew neck, navy pants, and white sneakers. His soft and glamorously cut gray and beige tailoring that defined yuppie, power broker living in the 80s and 90s. His prescient cultivation of the Hollywood fashion symbiosis, beginning with the outfitting of Richard Gere for American Gigolo in 1980. And his relentless work ethic and dedication to his business. After launching his company in 1975 at the age of 41, Armani built an empire, achieving a level of fame and success, including a personal fortune of around $12 billion, according to Forbes, to which few designers, Ralph Lauren aside, has ever come close. The name Giorgio Armani transcended the man to become a cultural shorthand for suave sophistication and success. Under the Armani's group umbrella, there is the men's and women's designer collection Giorgio Armani, the younger, trendier Emporio Armani, and its sport line, EA7, which outfits the Italian football club SS Napoli. Armani Collezioni, the luxury department store staple, Armani Privé, the haute couture collection launched in 2005, and Armani Casa, the home and furniture line launched in 2000 that creates a lifestyle best exemplified by the Armani Hotels. They first opened in 2010 in Dubai, where it occupies a number of floors on the Burj Khalifa. The second opened the following year in Milan. Everything is united by the Armani aesthetic, defined by a clean yet opulent architecturalism. Armani widely owns its own factories, production and distribution facilities, and retail stores, including one that occupies a full city block on Milan's Via Manzoni. Sartorially, the look that fueled Armani's fame was one of relaxed, unstructured tailoring, specifically the jacket. Shortly after establishing his own label in the mid-1970s, he showed a men's collection featuring a rumpled, unlined jacket that grazed and flattered the body and was a revelation in contrast to the stiff, constructed traditional suits that ruled common menswear. A few months later, he reinvented women's tailoring with a unique masculine allure by eliminating internal supports and padding. I do hope that my jackets have given them a relaxed feeling of security, he once told an Italian magazine, according to Vanity Fair profile from 2000, and the salutary feeling of being unattackable. In the 1980s, the Armani power suit for men and women, with its exaggerated shoulders, widened lapels inspired by the 1940s, and monochromatic silhouette became the radical signifier of a time of economic prosperity. As influential and era-defining as Armani's sensual suiting was, his relationship with Hollywood, the dynamic of power and sexuality that Armani's clothes represented was immortalized on screen in Paul Schrader's 1980 film American Gigolo, which features a shirtless Gear shimmying in front of a closet full of Armani suits, painstakingly selecting the perfect jacket, shirt, and tie in which to get down to business. But it was off-screen that Armani set a new standard, virtually inventing the modern epic of red carpet dressing and the fashion celebrity industrial complex. In 1988, Armani opened an LA office, hiring former journalist Wanda McDaniel, whose husband was Hollywood producer Albert Ruddy, known for The Godfather, as a liaison to the stars and everyone in their professional orbit, lawyers, managers, agents, producers, and directors. According to a 1995 story in the New York Times, it was McDaniel's job to invite celebrities to Armani fashion shows and make sure flights, hotels, and of course clothes were paid for. Since Ms. McDaniel's arrival, Armani has been available at deep discounts to those who can further the designer's cause in Hollywood, be they agents or celebrities, reads the Times story. "Mr. Armani would like to dress you," was reportedly how the overture was made. His fascination with cinema dated back to childhood, and Armani began dressing actors long before the opening of the LA office or his store on Rodeo Drive. Diane Keaton was the first person to wear Armani on the red carpet, donning a beige jacket over a long skirt when she won the Academy Award for Best Actress for Annie Hall in 1978. In 1990, Julia Roberts wore an Armani suit to the Golden Globes. Jodie Foster collected her Best Actress Oscar for The Silence of the Lambs in 1992 in an oyster Armani suit. Armani cemented long-standing relationships with Leonardo DiCaprio, Lady Gaga, George Clooney, and Kate Blanchett. Over the entirety of his career, Armani was famously unflinching in his commitment to his core aesthetic, even when the tides of trends and taste ebbed from his current. His atelier and circle of influence was tight, loyal, and highly guarded, including Leo Del Orco, head of menswear design, and his niece, Silvana Armani, head of womenswear. Rather than enlisting an outside stylist from fashion's preferred roster of star image makers for his runway shows and campaigns, Armani did it all himself, for better or worse. In the aughts and 2010s, critics complained that his collections were frozen in another time, with their predilection for funny hats and tricky pants. Even more confounding and fascinating to the press was, at first, the issue of a potential corporate merger. For years, rumors spun about an acquisition by LMVH, or Kering. It never happened. "I have no associates. I am not in the stock market. I am beholden to no one in what I do. If I spend billions on a fashion show, I spend billions. It's not public," Armani told Vanity Fair in 2000. Then there was the question of succession, creative and business-wise, within the Armani group. During a 2013 interview with the then New York Times fashion critic Kathy Horan, she asked him if he thought about who would take the reins next. Every morning, Armani, then 79, said, but he didn't see it happening anytime soon. So the solution is to remain here while I can and create a group of people that I can trust, with one person by my side. 8 years later, he told Vogue that he would pass down the business to family. He mentioned Del Orco and Roberta Armani, Silvana's sister, who had worked at the company for decades, landing eventually in public relations as his most outward-facing lieutenant. But even as he approached his 90th year, Armani remained the undisputed boss of the company. Giorgio Armani was born July 11, 1934, in Piacenza, Italy, where he grew up with his father, Ugo Armani, his mother, Maria Raimondi, and his older brother, Sergio, and younger sister, Rosanna. It was through his mother that Armani developed an interest in fashion. Though we grew up in post-war Italy and were very poor, she always ensured that my brother, sister, and myself were immaculately dressed. She was herself an innately elegant woman, he told The Independent in 2006. Initially, Armani pursued a career in medicine, enrolling in the Department of Medicine at the University of Milan before leaving for a brief stint in the army. Afterward, he dabbled in photography and got a job as a window dresser at premier Milan department store La Renaissante, where he eventually took a buying and merchandising position in the men's department. In 1965, Armani joined Nino Cerruti's business, designing menswear for the Hitmen line and freelancing for other Italian houses, including Allegri, Gibot, Montedoro, Seconds, and Tendress. Shortly after starting his work with Cerruti, Armani met Sergio Galeotti, an architect 11 years Armani's junior. Galeotti persuaded Armani to open his own design office in Milan and co-founded Giorgio Armani Spa in July 1975. The pair partly financed their venture by selling Armani's Volkswagen Beetle. Galeotti was Armani's one-time lover, best friend, and business partner until his death at age 40 in 1985. At the time, the cause of death was reported to have been a heart attack suffered after a year-long battle with leukemia. It was AIDS, Armani told Vogue in 2021. Their partnership was so essential to Armani's day-to-day operations, state of mind, creative decision-making, and business momentum that many thought the designer would be unable to forge ahead after Galeotti's death. Instead, Armani threw himself into his work, making it his life's purpose and greatest love. Nearly four decades later, he still named Galeotti as his biggest influence on his work. We're in the Hollywood and fashion section. Emily Blunt loves everything about returning for The Devil Wears Prada 2, except this. In an interview with Netta Porter, Blunt revealed her one complaint about stepping back into the heels of assistant-turned-high-powered executive Emily Charlton. This is by Alfredo Torriello on September 3rd. Just because you're good at something does not necessarily mean you want to do it. Emily Blunt regularly stuns on the red carpet. She recently turned heads at the Venice Film Festival 2025, where she dazzled in a Tamara Ralph gown. But that doesn't mean she always prefers to wear high fashion garments. In an interview with Netta Porter, the actor in Vanity Fair Italia September issue cover star revealed that she prefers more casual clothing. I drown myself in clothes, she explained. I quite like oversized. I like to hide. I like to shroud. That's another high fashion accessory Blunt isn't keen on. I don't love wearing heels, she told Netta Porter. It's not a huge surprise, as stilettos are not exactly synonymous with comfort. When going out, Blunt prefers to rock a pair of sneakers with perhaps some jewelry and a little makeup. But now that she's returning to the role of Emily Charlton, former assistant to Runway Magazine editor-in-chief Miranda Priestly, played by Meryl Streep, she's forced to wear heels every day on set of the sequel to The Devil Wears Prada. Getting back to The Devil Wears Prada has been a rude awakening for all of us, says Blunt, at least in terms of footwear. But reviving the iconic role of Emily Charlton, now a high-powered executive for a luxury group with advertising dollars that Priestly desperately needs, is well worth the spin, the pain, especially considering how highly anticipated the sequel is. Paparazzi have seemingly captured practically every moment of the shoot thus far. To survive it, Blunt says that she employs the zen approach of her co-star, Anne Hathaway, ignoring all the hoopla and letting the unwanted attention roll off her back. When we made the first movie, none of us expected the meteoric life that it would have and the impact it would have on people. As my husband said to me the other day, this is people's nostalgia bank, she said, referring to husband John Krasinski. I'm not sure I've ever been hit with the bombardment of the realization of what the movie is to people coming back to the film set. And that's what we all feel. Holy cow. That's what everyone says every day. Holy shit. A little announcement. Downton Abbey's Michelle Dockery is expecting her first child. The British actor, who's married to Jasper Waller-Bridge, revealed her baby bump at the premiere of Downton Abbey, the grand finale. This is by Antonella Rossi on September 4th. Michelle Dockery will soon be a mother. The British actor, who became famous for playing Lady Mary Crawley in Downton Abbey, revealed her pregnancy Wednesday at the London premiere of Downton Abbey, the grand finale, which will be released to theaters September 12th. Looking ravishing in a powder blue gown, the actor showed off her baby bump. The child will be the first for Dockery and husband Jasper Waller-Bridge, younger brother of Fleabag creator Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who accompanied Dockery on the red carpet. The actor and her husband, a creative director of a management company, were married in 2023 in an intimate London ceremony. Their wedding came just over a year after they announced their engagement in the pages of The Times, in a very classic informal manner. The pair has not discussed how they met, though they were first spotted together in 2019 at the Rome Film Festival. They married at St. Nicholas Church in Chiswick, London. Dockery's romance with Waller-Bridge follows her relationship with partner John Dineen, who died in 2015 at 34 from a rare form of cancer. Alan Leach, who plays Tom Branson on Downton, had introduced them. I refer to myself as a widow, yes. We were engaged and married at heart, and so I do consider myself a widow, Dockery told The Guardian of her fiancé in the aftermath of his passing. I've never been more committed to anything in my life than to him. So at the time, everything was just shut down. Work, everything. Work didn't matter. You suddenly become an oncological expert. This stuff becomes your world, and that, of course, was my priority. Our next headline, Paris Jackson has harsh words for Michael biopic. Not my monkeys, not my circus. Michael Jackson's 27-year-old daughter slammed the forthcoming biopic after Coleman Domingo, who plays Joe Jackson in the film, said that Paris and her brother Prince were very supportive of the film. This is by Monica Coviello on September 5th. The highly anticipated Michael Jackson biopic, Michael, won't hit theaters for a while, but it's already at the center of controversy. Paris Jackson, the 27-year-old daughter of the late King of Pop, took to her Instagram to slam the upcoming biopic from director Antoine Fuqua and director John Logan, calling it dishonest and saying that she has 0% involvement in the film. Jackson's comments came 2 days after statements made by Oscar-nominated actor Coleman Domingo, who plays Joe Jackson, the family patriarch, in the film. On Sunday, while leading the AMFAR benefit gala for AIDS research during the Venice Film Festival, Domingo told People magazine that Paris and her younger brother Prince Jackson were very supportive of the film. Paris Jackson, whom Domingo told People magazine has been lovely to him, also performed at the AMFAR event. I'm excited to be here at AMFAR tonight with Paris, he added. It feels like that's a nice way for us to be together. The feeling was apparently not mutual. On Tuesday, Paris Jackson responded directly to Domingo's comments on Instagram, distancing herself from the film. Coleman, don't be telling people I was helpful on the set of a movie I had 0% involvement in, LOL. That is so weird, she wrote. The singer and actress explained that she had seen an early draft of the film and pointed out the parts that she felt were unconvincing. I read one of the first drafts of the script and gave my notes about what was dishonest and didn't sit right with me, and when they didn't address it, I moved it on with my life, she wrote. Not my monkeys, not my circus. God bless and Godspeed. In follow-up videos posted to her Instagram story, Jackson expanded on her involvement with the film, saying that after she was explicitly informed her suggestions would not be considered, I wasn't involved at all, aside from giving feedback on the first draft and then getting the feedback that production was not actually going to address your notes at all, so I just butted out and left it alone because it's not my project. She continued saying that filmmakers are going to make whatever they're going to make, and that the project would most likely make her father's diehard fans happy. A big reason why I haven't said anything up until this point is because I know a lot of you guys are going to be happy with it, Jackson added. A big section of the film panders to a very specific section of my dad's fandom that still lives in the fantasy, and they're going to be happy with it. Michael has been in development since 2019 in collaboration with the Jackson family. It stars Domingo, Miles Teller, Nia Long, Cat Graham, and in his big screen debut, Michael Jackson's grandson, Jafar Jackson, as the pop icon. The film has already faced several controversies. According to Puck, the production has reportedly been mired in rewrites and reshoots. The entire third act of the film reportedly had to be rewritten and reshot, allegedly because the first version had overlooked terms of a settlement between the Jackson estate and a child abuse accuser. A source close to the production, however, flatly denied rumors that the production was a mess. The Michael Jackson biopic is not in total chaos, they told People magazine in January. The inflammatory headlines about the moving, halting are simply not true. The film is moving forward, and the reshoots are happening in March. Michael is currently set for release on April 24th, 2026 from Lionsgate. This is in the Rush Week category. The guys who made Needlepoint an SEC uniform explain why it's so frat-coded. The founders of Smathers & Branson, a power player in the Needlepoint belt biz, credit a girlfriend with helping shape the modern frat bro uniform. This is by Casey Wickman on September 5th. Everyone needs a way to keep their pants up, but men in a certain preppy subset, including boat shoe-wearing frat bros and their ilk, as well as the country club members they age into, have found a way to signal personal passions and organizational affiliations while doing so. Enter the Needlepoint belt, a colorful, waspy staple that might feature anything from a school mascot to a sailboat, a Grateful Dead dancing bear, an homage to a particular golf course, a pair of crossed hunting rifles, a cheeseburger, or thousands of other motifs. Once exclusively the domain of those who had a patient stitcher in their lives, often a girlfriend or doting grandmother, the heirloom's customization and creation can now be outsourced to companies like Smathers and Branson, a maker of needlepoint belts and accessories. Founded in 2004 by a pair of Bowdoin college students who were both gifted belts by then-girlfriends. I was just a 20-year-old kid given a neat little accessory with pink elephants and martinis on it. Not my bag, but I wore it dutifully. Austin Branson tells Vanity Fair of the birthday gift that would inspire his business. That girlfriend, Maisie, is now his wife. I had sailboats, kind of a coastal Maine scene, Peter Carter, whose middle name, Smathers, gave the business the other half of its name, adds of his own original belt, which he was coincidentally gifted about 6 months later. He's no longer in touch with his then-girlfriend. People would constantly stop the two on campus to marvel at the accessories. When the two of us were together, it'd be like, those are really cool belts. Where can I get one? Carter estimates that some 30 to 40 hours of stitchwork go into each belt, not to mention the cost of materials and paying to have the intricately stitched canvas mounted on a high-quality leather belt, transforming it from handcraft to wearable accessory. In short, it wasn't a casual project accessible to just anybody. Branson and Carter couldn't just volunteer their partners to make them for their friends, but they could pay a group of artisans in Vietnam to do so, leading to the creation of Smathers and Branson in 2004. The two frequented a stitch shop and learned needlepoint, though due to the responsibilities of launching and running their business, neither has ever finished a full belt or kept up with the practice, they admit. Branson, a government major with a minor in history, and Carter, an English major with a minor in archaeology, initially pictured the belts as an alternative to class rings or an ideal gift from universities to donors, taking the place of the chairs sometimes on offer. One such chair was visible on Zoom next to Branson, who wore a polo shirt emblazoned with the Bowdoin lacrosse logo while speaking with Vanity Fair. Before they could obtain licenses from the schools, however, they had to prove their business model. They started off with more generic motifs, sailboats, golf clubs, and the like, and began selling in boutique stores and menswear specialty stores, dreaming up designs specific to particular golf courses or destinations as well. About 2 years in, there was so much interest from the Southern men's stores, particularly saying, look, I'm selling your belts well, but you know, I could really sell a Clemson or a Georgia or a University of Texas belt very, very well, Carter recalls. They built a book of business proving that selling belts was a cinch and went back to the schools for the licenses. Colleges, Greek organizations, professional sports franchises, bands, and more gave permission for the company to commit their emblems to needlepoint. Now, Smathers & Branson offers not only belts, which can be customized with a multitude of emblems, but also embroidered key tags, hats, leather can coolers, and more. Though Baudouin didn't have a Greek system, the pair likened their college living situation to a frat house, touting the belt's appeal amongst golfers, campus dwellers, and more, with tales of men showing off their belt collections. Branson recalls watching the belt trend explode at the University of Georgia and Texas, to name just two schools. It's just mind-blowing, the next level of enthusiasm and passion there is for the college experience everywhere. Though needlepoint belts remain an eye-catching niche accessory, their prevalence in the preppy-leaning sartorial displays of campus bros is unsurprising. Articles of Interest podcast host and creator Avery Trufelman tells Vanity Fair. Trufelman produced a full season of her show around the idea of prep, attributing the style's prevalence to its being a sweet spot in the American dream. In the U.S., there's no formal class system, no monarchy. Dressing preppy, a trend that Trufelman says evolved from the casual style of Princeton students who would play tennis and then, gasp, stay in their tennis clothes rather than spiff up, is an accessible way to signal social rank, whether real or aspirational, and belonging. Trufelman points to a certain if-you-know-you-know aspect of classy preppy brands like J Press, which never displays logos and instead may use a school's colors in an article of clothing, for instance, as a sort of dog whistle for other alums to pick up on. The Smathers and Branson co-founders, too, call out that their pieces show the wearer's choice of emblems rather than any brand logo of their own, allowing the company to be both a golf brand and a tailgating brand, for example. Young women preparing for sorority recruitment are often advised to incorporate personal pieces into their looks to help them stand out. Similarly, Trufelman points to items like the belts as a social bridge. That's the fundamental thing about preppiness. It's an institutional look. It's about belonging, she says. Even if you don't belong, it's a way to look like you belong. It's a way to look like you went to these schools. It's a way to look like you go to these clubs. And though Smathers and Branson belts aren't necessarily made by a college girlfriend, they are hand-stitched and heirloom quality. Branson shows off a key tag that he's carried for some 20 years, featuring a stitched depiction of a golden retriever, the breed of his childhood dog. This is a sample, I think, from one of the first batches that we did, he said. It's been really loved. The idea that a young man may be able to inherit his father's needlepoint belt the same way he might wear a luxury watch passed down to him is part of the company's success with the preppy set. The men's space that we operate in doesn't change in the same way as high-end women's fashion, Carter says. Some of our best-selling patterns, like American flags or dogs, although we do change them from year to year, they don't change that dramatically. I think that's the same kind of thing within frat life, and then collegiate stuff, the game day clothes, they don't change necessarily. It's a classic traditional men's look that evolves, Branson adds. The shape of the khaki pant changes, the fit the guys are wearing different years change, but the same basic look is consistent. While I don't think of ourselves as like a Greek business necessarily, we fit into that as an element of what that customer, that demographic, has probably worn since the 60s. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are reading from vanityfair.com today, and we are ready to transition into the politics section. Our first headline is entitled, Amy Coney Barrett told Barry Weiss she's a huge fan of the free press. The Constitution is alive and well, declared the justice as she promoted her new book to a crowd that included judges, scholars, and Charlie Rose. This is by Christian Farias on September 5th. Leonore Tiefer, who is a retired and subscribes to the Free Press, came to the Lincoln Center on Thursday evening expecting Barry Weiss to explain herself. Weiss, who founded the popular Substack-based publication in 2022 and may soon join the Paramount Skydance universe to the tune of more than $100 million, according to Puck, was about to hit the stage with Amy Coney Barrett, who is kept busy this summer deciding high-profile emergency cases at the Supreme Court, largely favoring the Trump administration and its reshaping of Washington and the law. Their public conversation marked a kickoff of a book tour to promote Listening to the Law, which the Donald Trump-appointed justice describes as an effort aimed at readers eager to know more about what a justice does and how the court works. Tiefer wanted to know if the free press was selling out. "I thought the whole idea of the free press was independence from corporate media," she told Vanity Fair ahead of the event, as other subscribers, attendees, and special guests filed into the lobby of the Alice Tully Hall, which featured a cash bar and a table where of the book and merch, including the free press, socks, and t-shirts, were being sold. Vanity Fair purchased our copy of Barrett's book, which releases next week. The publisher, Penguin Random House, has declined to make a press copy available to this reporter, noting that copies would only be sent out around publication time. Whether Amy Coney Barrett was at all aware of this latest reporting, which signals that Weiss may be given a role at CBS News, long a political target of President Donald Trump and the Trump-controlled Federal Communications Commission, the agency that greenlit the controversial $8 billion Paramount Skydance merger this summer is unclear, as the subject didn't come up. What is known is that the Supreme Court justice who replaced the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg within days of the 2020 election really, really likes the free press. "I'm a huge fan," she told Weiss, its editor and founder, near the start of their conversation before a sold-out crowd that included other federal judges, scholars, and Charlie Rose. Sitting justices aren't normally in the habit of disclosing their media diet. Justice Antonin Scalia, for whom Barrett clerked, once told Jennifer Senior, then at New York Magazine, that he no longer reads the New York Times or the Washington Post because the publications had become shrilly, shrilly liberal. Corporate ownership of media organizations can be a tricky subject for judges and Supreme Court justices, especially if one of those conglomerates comes before them in a future case. Can you truly be impartial if you're a fan of a subsidiary of the parent company? Weiss, while introducing Barrett, took her own veiled swipes at the same legacy press where she once worked, for its apparent inability to make up its mind about the women sitting across from her. Will she be a threat to people's rights and the future of Roe v. Wade, as news organizations reported at the time of her nomination? Barrett cast the fifth vote to overturn the landmark decision in Dobbs v. Jackson's Women's Health in 2022, and the sixth vote in 2023 to end affirmative action in higher education. Or will she be liberals' last best hope at the Supreme Court, voting with the likes of Chief Justices John Roberts and Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson to put a stop to Trump's abuses of power? Save a few exceptions, the public record of her votes show they've been firmly aligned with the Trump administration. Maybe she'll just confound everyone. "Which is it?" Weiss asked. For little more than an hour, Barrett didn't so much answer the question as reassure her audience of New Yorkers who read the free press that the nation is holding up and she and the Supreme Court are going about their job, not giving people what they want, but only applying the law to cases as they arise. And if there seems to be a conflict between the President of the United States and the judiciary, we've been there before. Weiss ran through a mixture of softballs. "Tell us why you love the Constitution," to more ripped-from-the-headlines missives about recent and relatively recent landmark rulings, such as the one granting Trump broad immunity over the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the United States versus Scrimeti, which removed protections for gender-affirming health care for trans youth. A former legal academic at Notre Dame before becoming a judge, Barrett was a professional as she was technical in some of her responses. When Weiss asked Barrett how will everyday people know if we're in a constitutional crisis, Barrett didn't flinch. "The Constitution is alive and well," she said. "I don't know what a constitutional crisis would look like." "That is not the place that we are," she added. "It is plainly true that right now we're at a time of passionate disagreement in America, but we have been in times of passionate disagreement before." Barrett pointed to other times during the 20th century when the nation has been bitterly divided: the Great Depression, the Civil Rights Movement, and campus unrest during the Vietnam War. And we have come out stronger for it. Her prescription? To compromise, talk to one another, and to see each other as people and fellow citizens. Whether that's possible at a time the president is attempting to erect a national police force in more than one Democratic-led city or state, or else unleashing ICE on day laborers at Home Depots, is an open question. The Supreme Court, which at the moment is considering an emergency petition from the Trump administration to lift a judge's ruling barring immigration agents from profiling and arresting California workers on account of their looks, where they congregate to seek work, or simply for speaking in Spanish, has not been a model of unity and comedy during this summer's steady stream of fast-moving decisions on its so-called shadow docket. These rulings tend to be brief, leaving lower court judges with little guidance on how to proceed and at the mercy of an administration that trains its fire on judges who don't rule for Trump. It is inexcusable, one federal judge told NBC News in a report compiling frustrations from federal judges about the Supreme Court. They don't have our backs. Appearing to respond to that report, which featured interviews with 12 federal judges, Barrett struck a conciliatory tone. "Our district judges work so hard to get it right," she said. Indeed, Barrett herself has been on the receiving end of sharp criticism from her more liberal colleagues on this point, including from Justice Jackson, who had tough words for Barrett in the watershed decision in June, curbing federal judges' power to issue nationwide injunctions against the federal government. One especially sharp line aimed at Barrett: "I view the demise of the notion that a federal judge can order the executive to adhere to the Constitution, full stop, as a sad day for America." Weiss asked Barrett about her swipes back at Jackson, including this passage: "Justice Jackson decries an imperial executive while embracing an imperial judiciary, and whether she regretted any of it for being, as Weiss put it, Scalia-esque. "No," Barrett said, drawing applause. She added that Jackson's language warranted a response. "One thing Justice Scalia used to say that I love is, I attack ideas, I don't attack people," she added. "And if you can't keep the two separate, you don't belong on a multi-member court." When the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage, Scalia wrote, among other memorable lines, "The Supreme Court of the United States has descended from the disciplined legal reasoning of John Marshall and Joseph Story to the mystical aphorisms of the fortune cookie." In the end, the takeaway of the evening is much for Weiss as for Barrett, who has also been a target of right-wing figures, including from Trump land, appeared to be, keep doing your thing and don't let haters get to you. "To be in this job, you have to not care," Barrett said. "You have to have a thick skin." Our next headline is Donald Trump at the U.S. Open. Security snafus, booze you won't hear broadcast, and a Carlos Alcaraz win. Trump is accustomed to receiving a hero's welcome at UFC events and college football games, but the crowd largely jeered at the president at Sunday's final. Plus, a USTA source speaks to Vanity Fair. This is by Tom Clute on September 7th. Donald Trump was far from the cozy confines of the UFC octagon. The howling approval that greets him in the country's college football enclaves had been replaced by something far less welcoming. On Sunday, Trump entered a familiar but less hospitable sporting arena. Returning to the U.S. Open for the first time in a decade to take in the men's final between Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner, which Alcaraz won. Trump's presence was felt even before the first serve, with the scheduled 2 p.m. Eastern Time start time pushed back more than a half hour to accommodate the intensified security presence. As spectators took their seats inside Arthur Ashe Stadium, Trump mingled in his center court suite, where the U.S. Open trophy was prominently displayed. When he initially appeared, only briefly, before the half-empty venue, the president was greeted with a mix of whistles and, for better or worse, boos. During the pre-match national anthem, Trump stood saluting alongside Rolex CEO Jean-Frédéric Dufour, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Attorney General Pam Bondi, First Lady Melania Trump, granddaughter Arabella Kushner, and son-in-law Jared Kushner. When he appeared on the video boards midway through the rendition, another mix of loud boos and cheers echoed inside the cavernous stadium. After Alcaraz eased his way into a first set victory, however, Trump drew a decidedly more negative reaction when he was shown on the video boards. A number of individuals throughout the stadium could be seen standing and applauding, but the derision was near deafening. Camera operators remained fixed on Trump, allowing him to linger on the boards as the jeers rained down. All the while, Trump displayed a smirk with pursed lips. There was reason to believe the reception could have been even worse. After all, Trump was booed loudly the last time he attended the Open in 2015 when he was still only a candidate. Tennis's final major of the year, a magnet for New York's power centers of business, media, and entertainment, is the type of A-list, culturally liberal gathering that Trump used to frequent. He was a regular at the Open for years before he started wearing red baseball caps. Now, with much of the celebrity and entertainment world still at odds with Trump, the tournament represents a bastion of Trump's pre-MAGA era. A Fox News headline over the weekend summed up the dynamic. Left-leaning Hollywood elite flocked to U.S. Open with Trump set to attend men's final. One recent poll found that although sports fans generally lean right, tennis fans tilt liberal. The scene at Arthur Ashe last Sunday may have foretold some of Trump's booing this week. On that afternoon, fans showered the embattled late-night host and Trump scourge, Stephen Colbert, with a rapturous ovation as Colbert and his wife took in earlier matches. During changeovers at Ashe, luminaries seated in courtside boxes and luxury suites are typically shown on the video boards inside the stadium. Unlike Trump, most have been received warmly. Shonda Rhimes, Jon Bon Jovi, Hugh Jackman, and newly enshrined Baseball Hall of Famer CeCe Sabathia. Each drew applause commensurate with their stature and public standing. But there was something extra in the ovation for Colbert last week, who, in his final season as host of The Late Show after CBS announced in July that he will be canceling the program. The network insists the decision is purely a financial one, but to many, including, presumably, fans at the U.S. Open that day, it seemed politically motivated, with Colbert serving as a sacrificial lamb in order to secure a merger between Skydance and Paramount, which have formed CBS's new parent company. The Federal Communications Commission approved the merger a week after CBS said it is pulling the plug on The Late Show. The acclaim for Colbert at the Open last week felt more like an expression of solidarity than simply an assertion of fandom. It was the ideological inverse to the hero's welcome Trump received at a UFC event in New Jersey in 2024, 2 days after he was convicted of 34 felony counts. UFC, of course, is a pillar of the uber-masculine culture that Trump has exploited to tremendous political effect. He is drawn from a similar well of support within the frat boy world of college football. Those sports, favored by Trump-friendly personalities such as Joe Rogan, Theo Vaughn, and Dave Portnoy, have become central components of the MAGA brand. The Open, on the other hand, represents a link to a time before Trump became the Republican standard-bearer, when he was more identified with The Apprentice than politics, and still mostly embraced by the Hollywood set. A source told me that the United States Tennis Association, the organization that runs the U.S. Open, learned earlier this week that Trump could potentially attend, a development that upended the tournament's normal course of operations. As of Saturday, according to the source, the USTA still wasn't sure what Trump's plans were for the post-match trophy presentation. After the final match of the FIFA Club World Cup in July, Trump surprised members of the winning Chelsea FC squad by remaining on the dais during the trophy presentation following their title. Fans and credentialed guests on Sunday were subject to long lines through Secret Service-run security checks, which also limited mobility throughout Arthur Ashe. Making matters worse, the sublime weather that typified this year's Open experience gave way to soggy conditions this weekend, forcing organizers to close the stadium's roof for both the women's final on Saturday and the showdown between Alcaraz and Sinner. But entering Sunday's match, there was a question of how Trump's presence might affect the viewing experience for those watching at home. The USTA circulated a memo, first reported by the tennis journalist Ben Rothenberg, ahead of the final, asking all broadcasters to refrain from showcasing any disruptions or reactions in response to the president's attendance in any capacity. A spokesman for the USTA said the guidance was business as usual. We regularly ask our broadcasters to refrain from showcasing off-court disruptions, he said. Trump's schedule during his first 7 months back in office have doubled as a sports fan's bucket list. Earlier this year, he became the first president to attend the Super Bowl, and he was on hand for the Daytona 500 the following week. In March, Trump traveled to Philadelphia for the NCAA Wrestling Championships, and last month the president announced that he will attend the Ryder Cup at the invite of the PGA Tour. Maggie Zakak, a cosmetic chemist from Philadelphia, lamented that politics would seep into Sunday's match between Alcaraz and Sinner, the third U.S. Open final she's attended. "I just think with the state of our country, I would be much rather be able to overlook that for one day," Zakak told me as she prepared to go through the gauntlet of security outside Ashe. "I feel like this is a place to come and enjoy the sport and not have to focus on someone who's not quite doing the best for our country right now." Zakak is no fan of Trump, but she figured others at the Open final might be. The tournament welcomes around 1 million fans through the gates, a figure that renders partisan homogeneity nearly impossible. A graduate of the University of Alabama, Zakak was at one of the Crimson Tide's football games that Trump attended, where she recalls hearing a smattering of boos. "It was drowned out by cheers," she said. "Even in those more right-leaning spaces, there are always liberal people." Zakak noted that a pricey event like the Open, particularly Sunday's final, where the cheapest tickets were going for around $800, was bound to attract some Republicans. On Sunday, Trump was reportedly the invited guest of Rolex, one of the Open's many luxury sponsors. A spokesperson for the Swiss watchmaker did not respond to requests for comment, including a question about whether the invitation was part of a lobbying effort to get Trump to soften his trade policy. Last month, Trump set a 39% tariff rate on goods imported from Switzerland. Two of Rolex's athlete ambassadors, Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz. Trump remained in his suite after Alcaraz triumphed in the fourth set to clinch his second U.S. Open title. Alcaraz, who said Friday that Trump's attendance at the final would be great for tennis, made no mention of the president during his post-match speech on the court. When ESPN and ABC broadcast a shot of Trump at the end of the match on Sunday, as the crowd stood in ovation, the president did not appear to clap. This next article was actually from last week, but I didn't have time to get it into our last recording. Why Donald Trump death rumors and health conspiracies will keep going viral. Over the weekend, rampant speculation that the president was gravely ill took hold across social media. It's probably going to keep happening. This is by Natalie Korak on September 3rd. Donald Trump appeared live from the Oval Office on Tuesday, standing in front of a podium and, though having emerged nearly an hour later than scheduled, looking entirely normal. Flanked by members of his administration and select Republican members of Congress, Trump announced that the U.S. Space Command would be moving from Colorado to Huntsville, Alabama. It was a seemingly mundane announcement, but the live appearance had a deeper significance for the Chronicle Online, proof of life after a weekend of rampant speculation about his health. Presidential vitality has long been a reliable font for conspiracies, but the speed and breadth of the most recent round of speculation, spurred largely by a lack of scheduled public appearances, some slightly inopportune asides from Vice President J.D. Vance, and a news aggregator powered by the online betting site Polymarket, served as a reminder of how singular a figure Trump is in such matters. His tendency to engage with rumor and speculation himself, and the rabidity of his feelings he inspires in admirers and detractors alike, both seem to play a large role. Trump's death has been the subject of a lot of online content for years now, but especially over the past year since he took office. Taylor Lorenz, an internet culture journalist and the author of Extremely Online, tells Vanity Fair. As morbid as it might be, she adds, there's this pent-up anticipation and excitement for it to happen. When people notice a confluence of any activity relating to Trump's health, it becomes an opportunity to post jokes about the possibility of his passing, which fuels further speculation. It just sort of feeds itself, Lauren said. It feels cathartic for these people that feel like Trump has done enormous harm over the past two terms, Lauren explains, noting that's why you see Spotify playlists titled with some variation of When It Happens, made in preparation to celebrate Trump's eventual demise. Adam Cochran, a tech and crypto investor, as well as an academic who conducts what he considers to be independent investigative journalism, contributed extensively to the discourse, posting a 31-part thread proposing that the White House was partaking in a cover-up, with Cochran's follower count of more than 200,000 on X, plus the additional boost that the platform's verification system provides. The first post on his Sunday afternoon thread has been viewed 11.3 million times, amassing 71,000 likes as of Wednesday afternoon. He argues that while some people, himself included, would celebrate Trump's no longer being in office, that is markedly different than wishing him ill. Cochran tells Vanity Fair that in most cases, the crass jokes about Trump's demise stem from people's frustrations rather than actual wishes of harm. During his Tuesday press briefing in the Oval Office, Trump was asked about the theories, dismissing them as fake news. Trump claimed that he was very active, actually, over the weekend, referencing his exhaustive Truth Social posting and visits to his Virginia golf club. He also pointed to appearances last week, including an interview he did with the Daily Caller. Concern over Trump's transparency on the matter of his personal health is not entirely unwarranted. At the end of his term, Trump will be the oldest serving president ever, and his second term follows Joe Biden's tumultuous presidency, which was often overshadowed by intense speculation over the now former president's mental acuity. Trump has never been forthcoming about his health, New York Times reporter and Trump chronicler Maggie Haberman told me in a June interview. She recalled October 2020 when Trump, who she said views sickness as weakness, was diagnosed with COVID and reportedly turned out to have been far more ill than he and the administration let on. Some officials believed, per Haberman, that Trump could have died had he not been given a Regeneron treatment involving monoclonal antibodies. That's scary how perilous that moment was and how little real-time information the public had, Haberman said. In July, the White House announced that Trump, who is 79, had been diagnosed with chronic venous insufficiency, which his physician, Sharon Barbarella, described in a memo as benign and common. Barbarella also addressed a bruise that had recently been seen on Trump's hand, deeming it consistent with minor soft tissue irritation from frequent handshaking. Photographs from Tuesday's Oval Office press conference appear to show that one of Trump's hands was still bruised, not entirely concealed by a layer of makeup. The latest round of speculation slowed somewhat on Saturday morning when Trump was spotted by pool reporters on the south lawn of the White House, where he was photographed with his granddaughter, Kai Trump, as they prepared to head to his golf club. His appearance was paired with a flurry of Truth Social activity that extended late into the evening, covering a wide array of topics, including the newly renovated Rose Garden, crime in D.C., voter ID, and the congressional blue slip process. Yet on Sunday, a post from Trump featuring a photo of himself and football coach turned Barstool Sports personality John Gruden playing golf sparked theories again. While the post didn't specify that the photo was taken that day, it didn't help that Gruden had posted a photo of himself in the same outfit just over a week prior. Trump seemingly addressed the theories in a post on Sunday afternoon, writing, all in caps, of course, "Never felt better in my life." Even if the Truth Social posts and Tuesday's live announcement have been able to somewhat quell rampant speculation for the time being, these things snowball, Loren says, and it's like a pressure valve. As of Wednesday, the polymarket odds on Trump's being out of the presidency by the end of the year hovered around 6%. And we have time for just one Levin report this week. What's going on with the Lisa Cook, Donald Trump Federal Reserve drama? The Justice Department has reportedly opened a criminal investigation into Cook, the Federal Reserve governor the president is trying to fire. This is on September 4th. The head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency took to CNBC on Thursday morning to defend Donald Trump's firing of Dr. Lisa Cook, a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. During a contentious interview, Bill Pulte, the Trump appointee who publicly accused Cook last month of committing mortgage fraud and his claim to have invented Twitter philanthropy, insisted Cook's firing was not politically motivated, refused to divulge his sources and methods, and told co-host Andrew Ross Sorkin, "I don't need you to help me explain things, Andrew." But let's explain how we got here. Throughout his first term, and for most of his second, Trump has been extremely angry with the Federal Reserve, whose policymakers he apparently thinks know less about being good stewards of the economy than he does, a man whose companies have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy 6 times. Often that anger has resulted in Trump's publicly lashing out at the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, whom the president has called, among other things, low IQ, a stubborn mule, a very stupid person, and a knucklehead. But in late August, the president turned his ire on Cook, whom he accused of committing mortgage fraud and fired via Truth Social, a move he would undoubtedly like to follow up by replacing Cook with someone inclined to give him what he wants, i.e., lower interest rates. Cook has denied the fraud allegations and sued the president, saying he lacks the cause to get rid of her. Where do things stand? What does this mean for the economy? Who is this Bill Pulte guy? Your burning questions answered. What has Trump accused Cook of doing? In a letter posted to his Truth Social account on August 25th, Trump accused Cook of committing mortgage fraud, specifically claiming that she indicated on 2021 mortgage documents that both her home in Michigan and her house in Georgia would be her primary residence. He wrote that he was removing her from position effective immediately and added, "The American people must be able to have full confidence in the honesty of the members entrusted with setting policy and overseeing the Federal Reserve. In light of your deceitful and potentially criminal conduct in a financial matter, they cannot and I do not have such confidence in your integrity." On Thursday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump's Justice Department had opened a criminal investigation into the allegations against Cook. How has Cook responded? She's denied the accusations, with her attorneys declaring in a court filing that she did not ever commit mortgage fraud. Cook's lawyers, who have sued the president on her behalf, also told a judge that even if she had done the things Trump has accused her of, they would not rise to the level at which he could fire her for cause, particularly in light of the Fed's status as an independent organization. Setting aside the fact that Governor Cook did not ever commit mortgage fraud, any such pre-office offense plainly would not have been so infamous in nature as to render the offender unfit to execute any public franchise, they wrote. Cook's team has argued that her firing was politically motivated and tied to Trump's anger at the Fed for not lowering interest rates this year. They've also claimed her due process rights were violated when she was not given an opportunity to respond to the allegations prior to being fired. What does it mean for the Fed if Trump is able to remove Cook from her post? It wouldn't be great. This is a kill shot at Fed independence, Brookings Institution senior fellow Aaron Klein told Bloomberg. Trump is saying the Fed is going to do what he wants it to do, by hook or by crook. A letter signed by hundreds of economists condemns Cook's firing and the unproven accusations against her, declaring they threaten the fundamental principle of central bank independence and undermine trust in one of America's most important institutions. That trust is a cornerstone of the system that has fueled America's economic vitality over the decades. This brings us to the end of our time together on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. Come back next week, and we'll have another hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.